Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today we have with us Mr. Giovanni Intila, the export manager of Rustichella d'Abruzzo. I hope I'm saying that correctly, Giovanni.
Hi.
So I thought it would be an interesting thing for our listeners to hear something about what dried pasta production is like in Italy. Everyone goes through the grocery store and sees all the boxes or bags down the aisle. You guys make a beautiful product for a dried pasta. What is the history? What is the story of Rustichella d'Abruzzo?
Yes, Rustichella d'Abruzzo is an artisan pasta factory founded in 1924 from a family, the Peduzzi family, and they were millmen, and they started to produce pasta now exactly 90 years ago. The artisan pasta, handmade at those time, and now they become one of the most recognized premium brands in the world, in the USA in particular, but also in other 65 countries in the world.
How is the pasta made now?
The artisan pasta is quite different from the industrial pasta because the production process is completely different. The artisan pasta recreates exactly the sun drying process that they used to have in ancient times. So when they used to use the streams from the mountains and the streams from the seaside to dry the pasta under the sun. Actually, we don't do that now, but we recreate the same process in drying rooms where there are cycles of humid temperature and cool temperature to achieve the same slow drying process. To dry the pasta at slow temperature, long time, is an essential point in producing premium pasta.
Does it change the texture of the pasta?
Well, the premium pasta is actually made by different characteristics. The first one is the quality of the semolina flour. The second one is the temperature of drying. And the third one is the long time of drying the pasta. And it is also very important in premium pasta, the bronze dyes. It means that the pasta has a rough surface. That's completely different from the Teflon pasta that's a product from the mess industry.
Can you tell us why there are all the different shapes of pasta, what that means, or cooking reasons?
The different shapes. In Italy, every region and every province has its own tradition. So it's usual that in every town or in every province, you find a different shape of pasta. So that's why every pasta has its own favorite sauce. For example, trofie that are from Genoa, they are made essentially with the pesto, the Genoa pesto. So for each shape, there is a dedicated sauce. So every region has developed its own shape with its own sauces. That's the reason of so many pasta and so many sauces. Because every town, we can say every town has its own typical characteristic pasta and sauce.
Is there a pasta shape that sells very well, that is very popular in Italy, that is not popular to the export markets?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I mean, we do produce more than 160 shapes. And in some countries, some shapes are popular and in other countries are less popular. An example, fregola sarda, it's very popular in the States now, and in Italy it's actually very popular just in Sardinia. That's the island where the fregola sarda is typical, is common.
So how much pasta are you producing for the Italian market, and how much is for the U.S. and other markets around the world?
We do produce 15% for the Italian market, for domestic market, and 85% for abroad markets. And within abroad markets, the USA is the main market. It's the most important market. We can say that at least one-third of the production for export is addressed to the United States market.
Why would you use dried pasta versus fresh?
Well, I say fresh pasta and dry pasta, they are typical from some region of Italy. So Emilia-Romagna, it's a region of Italy that's famous for the fresh pasta. I mean, the tradition of fresh pasta is coming from Bologna town, and like tortellini, lasagne, fettuccine. But there are many other regions that produce fresh pasta, also in Rome or in many other regions of Italy. So actually, fresh pasta and dried pasta are two legs of the same tradition. We cannot figure out Italian cuisine without fresh pasta or dried pasta. Some dishes, like spaghetti, cannot be produced as fresh pasta because you need texture. And some dishes, are like fettuccine, they are typical, cannot be produced as dry pasta. So these two traditions are both essential in our culture, in our tradition.
Do you have some favorite recipes for the different shapes, maybe one or two different shapes of pasta? Accompaniments?
Yes. Every pasta can be dressed with his favorite sauce. In the tradition of Italian cuisine, we used to put a low number of ingredients. So the perfect Italian pasta dish is made with one or two or three ingredients and maximum. The base, it is always olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, garlic, tomato, and basil. Then you can add anything else. My favorite pasta dish is cacio e pepe. That's simply spaghetti, olive oil and garlic, and pepper, and pecorino cheese. Sounds That's my favorite dish.
Very good. That's a good favorite.
It's a very Roman dish.
Yes, I'm Roman, actually.
Very good.
Well, Giovanni, thanks very much for coming on the program.
Yes, thank you so much.
And for teaching us a little bit about Rusticella d'Abruzzo.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was fun to have Giovanni on.
Yes, it was. He's fascinating.
It's classic formal Roman.
Very. And I love the pasta dish he likes so much. So that's...
Oh, cacio e pepe is a classic. It's definitely like a hardcore. It's one of those like the Yankee caps on the guy from New York or something. Cacio e pepe is kind of like is the Roman thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hardcore dish in that it's just the pasta seasoned with the cooking water, which is pretty salty, lots and lots of black pepper, and cacio is the curd of meant to be the curd of the pecorino. Now, people use fresh pecorino because it's easier,
mm-hmm.
but back in the day, it was the curd of the pecorino and all of that. And then maybe if you're soft and you can't just take it, this crazy over-seasoned, you know, like, fat. The thing is, you got to nail the cooking of the pasta because there's no...
Yeah, because otherwise it's going to stick together. The pasta's got to be made perfectly.
It's a terrible test for a cook.
Yeah,
you know?
To have no fat in there.
Yeah, and people will add...
Or fat from the cheese.
People will add olive oil afterwards at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched someone in a restaurant in Rome ask for anchovies and throw anchovies and squeeze lemon and put olive oil all over the pasta. And the guy that owned the restaurant came and took the bowl of pasta away. It was one of the best things I've ever seen.
That's awesome. He was not deserving of that pasta. He ruined it.
I asked the owner what was up. He said he's Swiss. He can't help himself.
That's a good story.
So we have a bunch of questions that have accumulated for us. Do you want to?
Yes.
You want to pick some out?
Yes. You from David in Pasadena. You mentioned oil and butter makes a difference in how much oak you want in your wine. How does it change the dish or the wine on the palate?
Oh, that's David taking a very small thing and picking a very giant and complicated topic. How much oak there is on different kinds of wines may mean you apply it differently. You know, a very oaky California Chardonnay that's 14.5% alcohol or something is going to be very different to use with food, period. Oak adds some tannin, and tannin balances fat, but it's not as simple as this. And there's not a straight answer for this. So sorry, David.
Okay, David.
That's a complicated question that can't really be answered in less than some giant graduate seminar.
Annette in Laurel, Maryland, wants to know: asparagus season is coming up, isn't it? I've had difficulty finding an appropriate wine or beverage to pair with an asparagus soup that I make. Any suggestions? It's a simple cream of asparagus, green versus white, if that makes a difference.
Green versus white does make a difference. Is Annette a friend of yours?
No.
Because how many times between now and April 20th are you going to ask me when is asparagus coming?
Yeah. No, I just wait until April 20th. I don't ask anymore. Yeah, it is exciting.
It's if you want local asparagus, it's really consistent.
That's gorgeous.
Between the 20th, 25th, something like that. And if you can get it from the Eastern Shore, it seems like...
They produce some beautiful asparagus.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff out there.
It's a tough wine pairing.
It is. The best thing, number one for me by far, is Suave. There's lots and lots of lousy Suave that's produced. They're excellent producers of Suave Classico. You want to look for that on the label. Piro Pan is one. Pra, P-R-A, easiest Italian wine to spell of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Gini, G-I-N-I, another excellent producer of Suave Classico. But that's the best that there is.
Here's one for me, I think. Catonsville, Maryland. Eric wants to know any wine restrictions when making Sabayon. I love making it with port for strawberries, but haven't ventured into other varietals. I make Sabayon with Madeira, and I serve it with strawberries. So I've never made Sabayon with port, but I'm sure that's pretty. It might be a little overpowering.
It sounds pretty serious business. Yeah, one of you uses white port or...
I hope so, because, But, you know, really Madeira or Boal Madeira in particular, I love. And we were talking about that on one of the other shows. But you could always put champagne in your Sauvignon as well. It's a little harder to work with. But,
well, it's not as sweet either, so mm-hmm. you have to balance that out.
Compensate in your sugar. But the process of making Sauvignon is a little lengthy, and you really have to know what you're doing, but the result is so good. Sauvignon is one of my favorite things to have for dessert with fresh raspberries or strawberries.
This is where I get to wave the Italian flag.
There you go.
Sauvignon is the French ripoff of Zabaglione, which is a Sicilian sauce that's made with Marsala,
traditionally made with Marsala,
which is the sweet wine from Sicily. So that's a pretty easy wine.
And Marsala is delicious as well. So obviously that's the traditional way of making it. It's the right way. Miranda in Baltimore really enjoyed hearing the segment on the dinner party with multiple courses. Worry about serving too much food. Any recommendation on ounces per serving for the meat? My feeling on that is it does depend on just how many courses you choose to do. So if you're really 3 ounces, if you're doing 6, 7 courses, probably 3 to 4 ounces is fine.
Well, so what's the accumulation of protein going to be and how many hours is the event? And I always think managing the sort of carbohydrates on that dinner party is a lot. That's the trickier. Like if your sauces are rich and there's lots of carbohydrates on the meal.
Right. If you're serving rice and you're serving potato puree and, a pasta dish.
It doesn't matter.
You're in trouble.
Exactly.
Right.
I think as long as you have copious quantities of excellent wine, you're going to digest it all just fine anyway.
This is one of my favorite questions from Lynn in Colombia. Can I have dinner that features just champagne? Is that wrong? My answer
is
yes. It must be a friend of mine. She says she really loves champagne. What's wrong with having a champagne as a course? I mean, we have done dinner parties. We have
champagne
had,
is its own course?
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's what she meant. But, that's, well, sure.
It's time
start
for the
off
champagne
that way.
Course. Yeah.
Start off with your champagne course and then move into food.
Don't ruin our 1998 for the champagne.
But yes, I mean, and particularly having some older champagne, and I mean, I know this is your territory, but I love champagne and have done this many times. And of course, having a rosé champagne, a Pinot-based champagne that's got, more going on, something, fresh and move to rich and flavorful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a funny thing with champagne through a meal. There's a couple ways to go about it. You can go drier to sweeter, and that will take on richer dishes. You can go more Chardonnay to more Pinot, which, because of the nature of the breadth of those wines, will take on richer dishes. The most powerful wines remain Chardonnay from very sort of sacred plots, but the question is, like Salon Cruz Clos de Menil. Those are things that super, super intense and require a precise dish, but they can take on really rich stuff. Yeah, that's an easy question to answer.
Yes,
absolutely.
Absolutely is right. And I think that's it.
We have one from Miles in Colombia. When's it a can, a bottle of wine, and what are the benefits? I think I may have covered this before in a program, but not specifically as a question. The two reasons you decant a bottle of wine. One is the wine is young and quote-unquote tight, meaning it's not that generous when you first pour it into a glass aromatically. And you want to speed up the oxygen reaction, which is what gives off the aromas of the wine. When you decant the bottle, which is to pour the wine slowly into a container, pour it down the side of the container, and you need something that's spotlessly clean, not smelling like soap. I usually with a decanter will rinse the decanter out with a little bit of the same wine I'm about to decant in it, just to get it prepared, so it's not going to mingle with any dust or anything else that's in that container. But I'll pour it slowly down the side, and as the wine goes down the side, it's all exposed to a lot of oxygen, and that oxygen speeds up the waking that up. You know, maybe that's for a young wine. That also happens with older wines. The other reason to decant a bottle of wine is with an older wine, you're pouring clear wine off of sediment, natural deposit, pigments, solids, various polyphenols have coalesced into a natural deposit. And you'll see it on the spine of a bottle of wine laying in a cellar. And you're just going to pour that clear wine gently off of the deposit into a decanter, because it's not so nice to drink something very fine and smile at someone and have it look like you've been chewing tobacco in the front of your teeth.
It's
which is what
nice.
All that deposit ends up looking like.
I have a question for you, Tony. What wine should we have with pasta? Some of these dishes.
Like anything else, it depends on exactly what's going on. You name the pasta, and I'll give you a quick. Is it pasta tomato sauce? Something very simple.
Right. Yeah. Let's start with that. Something with basil, olive oil, tomato.
So then you want a red that has a good spine of acid, not too crazy alcoholic. Honestly, a relatively inexpensive Sangiovese can work very, very successfully with that. There's just a simple Chianti Colisinese, something like that, not a big piece of money. The richer the sauces, then the richer the Sangiovese is a pretty good rule for that kind of thing, if it's a tomato-based thing.
Or a filled pasta with, pasta filled with cheese and the brown butter sauce and fresh sage.
They're super interesting dry wines made from Lambrusco and sparkling, lightly sparkling, low-alcohol red wines from Modena also. That are delicious, but look for one that is dry and look for one that's high quality. One producer that does those is Ceci, C-E-C-I. But super interesting stuff to have and very traditional for pastas from Parma, from Modena, from Bologna. Thanks for listening to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're going to leave the studio and go do some pasta.
Yes, absolutely. Sounds good.